Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 62, recorded on March 28th, 2019. And with me today is a man, I mean, how can I describe this guy? He likes to fish. He enjoys making very delicious pickles, yet has no taste for them whatsoever and detests eating them. He is a geek among geeks in the photographic world and one of the hosts of DP Review TV. Today, I welcome Chris Nichols. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Don. Thank you so much for your very accurate assessment of me. And it's great to be back on the show. I really appreciate coming back.
Yeah, you know, I should have you on more often because, you know, we have a good sort of on voice chemistry back and forth. You know, when I have an opinion, you might not have the same opinion, but we can weave those two together into kind of a cohesive discussion.
Let's use the word synergy. Synergy is a great word. We're going to bring it
synergy.
Back.
Yes, it's very synergistic. Well, what's new in your neck of the woods, Chris?
Oh, not much. You know, it kind of goes along with my pick of the week for gear, which we're not going to talk about yet, but it's actually liquid water and above freezing temperatures, Don. It's been amazing. That's what we're all excited about.
Well, and I remember when we did at the beginning of winter, the DP Review TV episode where I was out in Calgary on macro photography. And there are a lot of comments on that YouTube video, but me only wearing a shirt in the frigid snow. I live and breathe the winter and I don't really enjoy it. Like I don't ski. I don't do any like other like winter outdoor activities other than photography. So, you know, I put like 5 or 6 hours into cleaning up the gardens today. And just before we started recording, I was in my studio shooting some ultraviolet fluorescent images of flowers that I have blooming. One of the garden centers had some Christmas rose varieties and anything in the Helleborus species, any variety will have very vibrantly glowing pollen. And so I bought a couple of those and they were in studio along with some succulents that I had that were just blossoming at this time of the year, all shot on the new Panasonic S1R, which nice. I've been loving. I'd shot with the S1 for snowflakes over the winter and I've got my hands on an S1R, an S1R now to just play around and see what it can do. And I have been quite impressed with that camera so far. And I know you've had your hands on that one too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We got to play around with it in Barcelona, of all places.
They send you to Barcelona. I don't get to go to Barcelona.
It was a very interesting camera. You know, for street photography, I think I would have preferred the S1, but how are you enjoying that 180 almost megapixels resolution in multi-shot mode? It's obscene.
Well, you know, one of the things that I found a great use for that for is artwork reproduction. My wife is getting ready for some art exhibitions, and she's a great oil painter. And so I did some, you know, I usually use flash, but I set up some continuous lights so that I could use this particular feature. And then I used the same setup to digitize some very old World War II era photos for a friend of mine, because as I'm sure you know, if you optically print, in a darkroom from a larger format negative, the detail in the print is just astounding. It's well beyond what a digital printer can create today at 300 or 600 DPI. And so to have that extra resolution really captures as much as you can, in those old images too. And it has performed stellarly. I don't have enough time. I haven't played with every single feature on the camera, but I've been loving it. And the reason why I want to bring that up is because shortly after the announcement of the S1 and the S1R, in the last couple of weeks, Leica has announced the successor to the Leica Q, the Leica Q2, not a very imaginative name, but the camera itself, it looks like a tiny S1R from at least the spec sheet, because it's got to the pixel the same number of pixels and the same size of sensor, and I can stipulate that it might be the same sensor, I have no idea, and the same thing for the viewfinder. And it's a very small, compact, as far as a full-frame camera goes, with a fixed lens. And I thought to myself, is this the first Leica camera that might be worth its price tag? And you've had your hands on one, right?
I have had my hands on one. And we went to Edmonton, of all places, to use it in the ice castles there. That was a pretty neat event. You know, it was very interesting. Of course, the sensor has been updated. I think one of the most interesting things about it that we still want to fully test is the native 50 ISO. You know, I would say low light performance is maybe not quite as good as what you're seeing out of a similar camera like the Sony A7R, something like that. But it's got this dynamic range ability, this ability to push shadows, which was remarkable. And the grain structure looks very organic, very Leica-esque. The JPEG color is still absolute garbage. Nothing you can do about that. But I also really like that they kept the same lens, and the Leica Q's 28 millimeter was always brilliant, but I was really excited to see that that same lens on this sensor easily handles the extra, or I should say easily delivers the extra resolution that that new sensor demands, and does it beautifully. So, right. You know, I think it's an even better pairing of high resolution and excellent lens. And if you think about how much a Leica 28 millimeter lens would cost at a 1.7 on its own.
On its own, yeah.
Yeah, you know, we're still getting a pretty good value. It was a fun camera to use. And that's really how I define Leica cameras. Not by value for dollar, but did I have a unique, fun experience? And I did.
Yeah, well, and Leica's always kind of marketed themselves towards the experience, right? And you can see that in their classic headliner, the Leica M series. And it's funny because just this week, I was actually I've got a Leica. I think it's officially pronounced Stemar, but it's pronounced like it's spelled like it should be written Stemar, stereo right. Elmar from the 1950s. And I was excited because I like stereo photography. It's one of my unusual passions in the photographic space. And this is a full frame Leica lens that was designed to be used on either the Leica 3 series or the Leica M series. This is an M version that I have. And I bought the M to L mount adapter, the Leica version, which is stupidly expensive for what it is. But I really wanted to pair this with a Panasonic S1 or S1R. It doesn't fit. Because just the way that the L-mount body behaves, this lens, if you're not familiar with how a 3D lens would operate, it has two lenses within the same, two separate sets of optics within the same barrel. And each one of them will interfere with each other unless there's a septum that drives all the way into the camera body as close to the sensor as possible. And the septum is 29 and a bit millimeters tall, but there's a little window around the sensor on the S1 and the S1R that is 26 millimeters. And then, of course, the sensor is 24 millimeters, so it just gives a 1 millimeter spacing on either side. But it means the septum is too big and it won't fit.
Dremel tool.
So, well, I've got a little bit more of an elegant approach. I've measured out every single aspect of that, and I'm working with a 3D modeler, actually the same guy that made the snowflake ornament that I had a few years ago. And he's working on creating a direct 3D model of the sort of back protruding into the camera body element. And we're going to modify that so that it will fit on the S series bodies. And nobody cares about that but me, so I should shut up about it.
It is always fascinating to hear, Don, your very unique passions and explorations. Because I would have just taken a Dremel tool to it, and it probably would have wrecked a very nice
lens.
Yeah,
well, it's probably the most expensive lens that I own. Not, again, because it's worth it, but because it has the Leica brand and a certain rarity to
of
it
course.
And what have you. I want to keep that original back end piece accurate. And I had to measure not just the distance, like the flange distance that they say is, I think, 19 millimeters or so, but I need to measure the distance between the lens mount and the shutter mechanism. Because right. if I don't get that right and it protrudes a little bit too far, then the shutter hits the septum when it fires, because these cameras natively have the shutter open when right. you're not shooting, because you need to see the sensor for the live view, the electronic viewfinder. And so I had a head scratching moment. It's like, okay, the shutter is never closed. Like when I have the lens off, how do I get the shutter to be closed? And fun trick, doesn't break anything, by the way. If you do a long exposure shot and the camera triggers its long exposure noise reduction, when it does that, it has to close the shutter to take a second exposure to unmap the noise. During that, remove the battery and the shutter stays closed.
You are a pioneer, sir. I'm gonna stick to one lens that projects one image onto one sensor myself for the near future, but I do applaud you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You know, the down the rabbit hole I go. Okay, let's get into the stories for this week. It's kind of a slow news week, but there is some interesting things to opine on beyond the headlines. So the first one comes to firmware. We actually have three stories, and I kind of group firmware updates into three different categories. Hmm. Number one, you have the stuff that should have been in there to begin with. It could be a fix for a problem or something like you rushed the camera to market and you didn't do the proper field testing of all of the settings and options and what have you, and you have to scramble to fix things. That's one.
Very, very frustrating and very accurate. Yes, that happens a lot.
And the other one is the camera's been out for a while, but new technology has evolved. Maybe you have access to new patents, or you have just found different ways and better ways to do things that weren't possible when the camera was released. And we've seen this many times over the years. I remember, I think the original 7D had a major update, and that was the big groundbreaking one, where even like the buffer for the camera was through software in the camera, greatly enhanced the amount of buffer space that you could use through some new compression algorithm and what have you. And so that's one. And the third one would be paid upgrades. And those paid upgrades could offer a feature that 95% of the people using the camera don't necessarily care about, but the research and development of that would be much more expensive. And so you have to find a way to make that worth your while to offer that particular feature. Yes. And there might be patent encumberment and things like that that will cost you extra dollars in order to put that feature in a camera. So you're going to charge a little bit extra for it. So these three categories, we have one of each this week. So Panasonic, we'll head off with them. They are in the third category. So they just announced, this was today, March 28th, that the S1 is going to have 10-bit and V-Log paid upgrade coming in July, in a couple of months. So this will bring 422 10-bit 4K internal recording at 24 and 30 frames per second. And if you have a an external recorder, like I have the Atomos Ninja V, which I actually used when I was in Calgary, fell in love with when it was attached to my camera, and I bought one, I can do 60 frames per second using the external recorder there.
Very exciting.
With a V-Log recording, which is helpful if you need this level of quality. Then being able to not crunch the shadows and overexpose the highlights to kind of push things back into a middle ground so that it can be properly color graded afterwards. The only reason why you need this highest quality of video recording is so that you can build it into something else afterwards, right?
Yeah, you know, there's quite a few thoughts here. I mean, first off, I can't help but be reminded of when the GH4 actually had a major upgrade in this way. Now, that wasn't a paid one. They actually unlocked anamorphic shooting on the GH4. And that was just a fantastic bonus for people. It almost kind of breathed new life into a camera, which at that time was quite old. But V-Log has always been something that you've been able to buy on a lot of those cameras. The GH5, for example, GH5S. And of course, Jordan and I use it quite a bit. But it's always actually been a lighter version, V-Log L. And so what's really exciting about this upgrade is not only is it V-Log, but this is basically their highest end V-Log. It promises to have even more dynamic range than what you are getting on a GH5 or GH5S. Plus the fact that, of course, we now have a full frame sensor and all the joy that comes with that. I think it's very effective because, you know, Panasonic kind of said the S1R is going to be our art reproduction, our landscape, our major commercial work, studio kind of thing. But the S1 is going to be a hybrid between photo and video. And this is a really nice bump up. You know, if anybody has a GH5 and they want to get that same experience and capability with a full frame camera, this delivers. We don't know how much it's going to cost yet. I don't think it's going to be crazy, but hopefully I won't be unpleasantly surprised. But no, I think this is a great move. And 10-bit 4K 60p with an external recorder, that's pretty awesome.
Especially and if you need this feature, it's going to be priced within your budget. Like it's not going to cost you like the cost of the camera doubled up to unlock something like this. It's just going to be for those that want this. Again, I don't know what the price is either, but it's not coming to the S1R. And you know, I think that there's some logistical problems with that. I'm just speaking from my own ideas here.
I'd agree.
You have a 47 megapixel sensor on the S1R. That's, you have to kind of sequester that down to 8 megapixels, which is 4K,
yeah,
in order to make a useful video feed of that. And so you're doing a lot of computation, and the processors are only so good that you can only churn out so much, which is why it's more of a stills camera, whereas the S1, it has fewer pixels to deal with initially, only 24 megapixels. So then pushing that into that 8 megapixel 4K video format requires a little bit less processing power, and thereby you can do more. You have a little bit more overhead to push out the higher quality stuff on the S1. So we're seeing that. It is being realized right now with this firmware update. And, you know, I'm contemplating actually owning both of these cameras because I'm doing more and more video work. And to have that high quality at 24 or 30 frames per second without needing that external recorder, that could be a huge asset for me if I'm shooting in the field. So,
oh yeah. I mean, what I love about this upgrade is it's not, first off, if you're not a video person, you don't have to spend the extra money. I think that's great. I mean, that makes sense, you know? But also, if you are a video person, getting up to 10-bit without having an external recorder, getting Vlog, I mean, in the video world, these are legitimately large improvements in the video quality and capabilities that you have afterwards. And yet, I think it's also very... It's very timely, this release, because of course we have NAB coming up very shortly. There's lots of excitement about, you know, is Panasonic going to come out with something? I mean, where's the Sony A7 S3, right, that we've all been waiting for? Yep. That's got to be around the corner. And so, you know, maybe this is a bit of a preemptive, like, you know, hey, just so you know, we're not leaving in the dust. We have no release date officially. We're thinking, you know, middle to late summer, but you know, just for people who are maybe looking at this camera, just be like, don't worry. Buy it now. You're not going to be disappointed. Check this out. This is pretty awesome. And Jordan and I are very excited to test this. We want to see exactly what it's going to do because it makes a big difference on our GH5s. It's one of the reasons why that camera, although not a new camera by any means or stretch of the imagination, is still our go-to for what we do.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because when I started using the first S1 that I had, the pre-production model that they sent me here that I was shooting my snowflakes with, used firmware version 0.5 or something.
Right.
It's really interesting to see how, like, when I tried to attach my Canon MPE 65mm lens to that with the NovoFlex adapter, it basically said no. Because it hadn't been fully fleshed out to use all of these extra accessories, right? You know, they sent it with the kit lenses and it was programmed for that, but you're at 0.5. You don't have all of these extra features to move forward with. And so I just put some tape over the electrical contacts as if there was no lens attached, and I used it that way. It was fine.
Right.
And of course, now with version firmware version 1.0, everything works perfectly fine as you would expect. And, right. And so there's a little bit of the behind the scenes sort of how the sausage is made. They build this up piece by piece. They don't just, you know, all of a sudden, boom, it's perfect, yeah, and it's completed. And so you look at that process, though, and you think you have to get it to a certain point. And then you have to ship because the shipping deadline is decided by marketing and top executives. But what if the firmware isn't absolutely polished? And that's where the next update, I think, might come in. Right. So Canon Asia has pre-announced an EOS R firmware update with better eye detection, autofocus, and bug fixes. So this is kind of my maligned firmware update where... you should have shipped it with this, and I know you rushed it and these are fringe cases, but you should have kind of covered this to begin with, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is really not only an example of having to fix a lot of bugs. I mean, let's be fair. Canon is not even close to the first manufacturer to release cameras incomplete. You know, I mean, Blackmagic has had some real issues and Nikon's done it and everything.
Everybody,
right? But, you know, Nikon had the Z6 and the Z7 coming out and Canon's like, look, we cannot let them sit there for a year while we try to figure out our cameras and make them work properly. So I get it. You know, I feel like a lot of people, especially people who've been in the photography industry and been shooting for, let's say, the last decade, have really you know, when they hear the word firmware, I would forgive them for having a negative opinion about that word, because they are used to buggy cameras needing fixes. This lens doesn't work. This feature doesn't work. This crashes. And firmware bug fixes were literally that. They were bug fixes. But at least in this case, I'm excited. I mean, the EOS R, it does have an eye detect focusing system that is such a big deal nowadays. I mean, Sony's really killing it, but Fuji's upping their game. Panasonic and Olympus are doing some interesting things. And so it makes sense now that we have eye detection that can focus in servo mode, not just in still stationary shots. Because the fact is, things with eyeballs eventually tend to move sooner or later.
Yeah, I mean, right? You're constantly looking around the frame. And so to have no access to servo AF when it's an organic experience, right? You're in the image, you're looking around at the different parts of the image to figure out exactly where the focus should be, what distractions you might have, what your subject should be. And then you lock on your eyes to where your main subject is, and the camera should always be fluidly moving around that. And I think that would be a very useful experience. And now you can have it.
Right. And I mean, Sony is killing it. I'm not trying to, you know, obviously I'm not trying to be biased or anything, but the A6400 really changed things. And I mean, we have new upgrades we're going to talk about as well. But yeah, like the Sony eye detect system is killing it. It's really how a lot of us feel it should have ever been in the first place. And Fuji's also stepped things up again with their new eye detect capabilities. And, you know, Fuji's an interesting side point, because when it comes to firmware, I'm not going to say they're solely responsible, but I'm happy to give them a lot of the credit for being a company that released cameras that worked, but then also released firmware updates sometimes years later that really made their cameras competitive even against new models coming out. And that really entrusts a lot of brand loyalty. It wins customers over. You know, you feel like this company is not just taking your money, they're going the further step to take care of you. And so, I mean, kudos to Canon for doing this, but yeah, you're right. It is a bug fix, and I never felt that camera's autofocus was complete when it came out either.
All right, so now hopefully it is more complete, but let's take a look at an older camera, because this is one that was a bit of an anachronism for me, the Sony A9, where they were trying to produce a product into the professional sports photographer space. And it kind of, it had a bit of a soft launch. I don't really think they put their full muscle behind it. Mm. And I was thinking to myself, well, they'll probably really hit it out of the park with the A9 II or whatever the successor is. And this is just a learning experience for them. Right. And however far off that may be, I'm sure they're going to produce it based on what I'm seeing from this firmware update. But, and again, another article from DP Review. You guys are talking all about the firmware here. Sony's A9 gets AI-powered AF modes and a redesigned menu in firmware version 5. Firmware version, do you know of another camera that's been up to a version 5.0 firmware?
It might be marketing, but no, I don't think. I mean, you know, the Sony A9, when we first tested this camera, it actually behaved very well. It was quite stable. It was quite reliable. But our takeaway was really not how amazing this camera is, but how much of a technical showcase it is for Sony. You know, you played with the camera, it became very obvious very quickly that this camera had some crazy technology with a shutter that's silent and electronic shutter mode with minimal rolling shutter, almost like a global shutter. You know, we're getting towards that kind of holy grail of shutters. And it had immense processing power that wasn't being fully utilized. So we figured down the road, if any camera could have some major improvements made and some major use of that processing power, it'd be the Sony A9. And when we went to Hawaii and we played with the A6400, of course, Sony announced, look, the A9, we're doing huge upgrades here as well. You're going to get better real-time eye autofocus, which is, as I've already said, incredible from the A6400, but also these new machine-learned autofocusing modes, smart object detection, being able to track things better. The real-time tracking is brilliant. And so, yeah, this is exciting. And it's one of these examples where maybe a lot of people looked at the A9 when it first came out and said, that much money for that camera, that's crazy. I'm going to stick to my SLR for sports and action. And maybe now you have to look at it and be like, wow, wait a minute. This might now at 5.0 really justify the price.
Right. And so they have a number of new features, a redesigned menu system, and I'm not familiar with the pre-existing one, but I have always found Nikon has been the worst Olympus, second worst, and Sony, third from the last in terms of the menu system. Being able to figure out things on the fly when I pick up like a student's camera and try to find a particular feature or option. And so hopefully they've been listening to feedback. And if they're making a point of notifying people that there is decidedly better organization for the menus, I'm all for that. Every camera manufacturer should be doing that.
Yeah.
And of course the autofocus advances that you said, but it's interesting. It's all the rage. Everybody's kind of leaning very heavily on the AI advancements, you know, the deep learning, whatever term you want to use,
yeah,
as processing power gets better, as the algorithms and the sort of foundation of input, you know, to figure out what is what, is getting better and better over time. And I think that that is an area that even with the existing hardware today, the software can improve leaps and bounds. So it makes a lot of sense to start rolling that out and building that into the core products that you have today. And so Sony's doing that. Great. You know, join the crowd. I think everybody will be doing that within a year.
Yeah.
But one thing stood out for me in this one. Image quality, and I'm going to read right from the press release here. Firmware version 5.0 offers notably improved image processing, which maximizes the capabilities of the full frame sensor. The camera now more accurately reproduces subtle changes in light for smoother, more natural tonal gradations and improved auto white balance results. Well, the auto white balance results, that's also algorithmic. But yes, the rest of that, that you more accurately reproduce subtle changes in light. That seems like they are applying that same AI mentality to smoothing out color gradients across across different subjects that they might be able to automatically recognize. And I did not think you could do that with raw data.
You know, this is a tough one because, of course, we've heard a lot of these things before. I mean, you know, a lot of companies have said, oh, this firmware is going to improve color rendition, you know, or we have tweaked our color science, or we have changed our dynamic range algorithms, or whatever. And, you know, the end result is usually pretty minor. So I'm taking this with a grain of salt because it is a press release and it does sound good. But at the same time, I think what's most exciting for me, this whole firmware thing we talk about, I almost feel like this word's going to have to go by the wayside because we are entering a situation and an era in photography where it really is about deep learning. I think it really is about computational photography. And a lot of the advancements we're going to see are not going to be hardware driven. They're going to be software driven. And rather than even look at these things as firmware updates or tweaks to a system, I think in the future, we're going to start seeing some major things added. Are they going to be app based? Are they going to be add-ons or modules that you can buy that you can tailor your camera to be more the way you need it to? I mean, are we going to get enhanced customizations? Are we going to get into a world much like the video game industry where a lot of this becomes like pay to play? You know, I mean, if this is what you want.
Well, I really want to interject here because, you know, Microsoft has just announced that Windows 7 service is ending for security updates in the next year or so. And they're starting to nag people about upgrading to Windows 10. But you can pay if your wallet is fat enough to continue to get updates after the average person doesn't receive them anymore. And so this is a model that they originally started with Windows XP because a lot of like ATMs and things like that used Windows XP and they couldn't be upgraded. And so it was a pay to play model. Do you want to keep getting updates? Well, pay us a little bit of money. What do you think about the model of having a subscription to firmware? You know, for the first 5 years after the camera's release, it's all free. But if there are new features down the road and you want to keep the same camera, you gotta pay on a yearly basis or on every update kind of basis. I think that might be coming in some form, but I don't know about it.
You know, I think you could look at it like anything. You could look at it in a very cynical way. I'm sure a lot of people who just heard that are probably doing that right now. They're like, oh, they're just going to try and screw us out of our money. And they're going to try to squeeze us for every little bit. And I want to go back to when cameras were cameras and blah, blah, blah. And I get it. But I think we have to appreciate that we're entering an era where, yeah, software is going to be a big defining factor. It's not going to be hardware changes. And therefore, if you want to unlock certain features, every other industry seems to be doing it, Don. So why not photography? And we got to appreciate that these companies are always trying to find ways to make their products more profitable, pay for the research and development, and justify all these developers. So you could look at it cynically. I look at it in a very hopeful way, because I think that a lot of the things that we've seen up to this point, a lot of the corrections, a lot of the firmware, a lot of the new features and new menus have always been somewhat gimmicky. And we're now reaching an era where companies are saying, this is what this new module can do. And then you play with it and you're like, wow, that actually significantly changes my photographic experience. It's not just a gimmick. It's not like Canon's eye autofocus way back in the day with like the EOS 3. We're talking about major changes that really.
Oh, you know, your camera's going back to the film era and specifically singing out the EOS 3. I mean,
it was a gimmick. It was a gimmick. It sounded great. It sounded like a dream. It was a total garbage. But, you know, nowadays these things sound like dreams and they really do deliver. So whether people like it or not, I think photography is going in this direction. And, you know, I think we are going to see more pay to play kind of features. I don't think that would be unheard of.
And I think that that would be a useful thing. Like, you've got your camera, you invested in that hardware, and you want it to last as long as possible. And if you've had the camera for 5 years and you're thinking about upgrading, but, you know, for $50, you can get better software because the hardware is good enough. The software has come along farther, and pay to just kind of keep pace. Yes, the hardware at a certain point, I think, will necessitate an upgrade of the actual camera, whether it wears out or there's just new inventions along the way. But the software will be that continuous flow. And I think that's the future that we're going to be looking forward to.
I agree. Absolutely.
All right. Let's move on to the next story here. Ariana Grande, who is a singer, if you've never heard of her, now requires photographers to transfer full image copyrights. And so, you know, concert photography is an interesting thing because it kind of plays by slightly different rules, most of them somewhat more draconian than we're used to when we might get hired to shoot a photography gig, or, you know, doing headshots or commissioned work or what have you. So basically, this is not the first time this has happened from any musical artist at all. But if you want to shoot an Ariana Grande concert, they own her company or her personally. That's kind of unclear because I couldn't find an exact contract here. But they own the rights, every right to everything that you produce. And right. You have no rights to do anything with it unless you get explicit permission to do so in writing. That seems a bit of an overreach to you. I mean, at least initially on the surface, it does to me.
Yeah, I mean, like anything, when we talk about photographic rights, we are definitely diving into the gray zone. You know, it's a tough one. You are going to a private event, so of course there's no legal issues with instituting this kind of policy. It's just, are people going to be okay with it? My first initial thought is, maybe photographers will just refuse to shoot these things. But no, of course they will. I think if anything, what it's going to do is not necessarily limit people's rights. It's going to let Ariana Grande's companies and managers decide which choice photographers they consistently want to give business to, because perhaps those photographers shoot things that they find are positive. But is it a form of censorship? Yeah, for sure. Is it far-reaching? I mean, I think in Canada, where we really enjoy very liberal and very photographer-protected rights in copyright law, it feels almost like an affront, but I don't know. Well, I mean,
but he, I did some digging and I found on TMZ or TMZ. Here we are in Canada. I won't get ripped off by photogs anymore. Hence my new policy, she says. And in there it says, we're told Ariana would perform and the photographers would take as many pics of her as they wanted. And then shortly after, merch that she didn't approve of would hit the streets with those photos emblazoned on items. And Ariana Grande never saw a dime from any of it. And yes, you want to protect your brand. And, you know, if you're a celebrity, you are your brand, Right. And so if people are just taking your images willy-nilly and throwing them out anywhere, then you want to have some level of control over that, or at least some way to go after people. If somebody wants to steal a photograph of Ariana Grande or any celebrity, musician or otherwise, and print it on mugs and sell it at some, you know, Chinese supermarket, in any metropolis, they're going to do it. You're not going to stop these people. So I don't know if it's really hitting the nail on the head to stop every photographer from owning their work at all. But if you want to shoot her concerts, you have to sign by this. And maybe some people get different agreements. Like you said, maybe they have some preferred people that they work with, that their contracts might be a little bit differently. But if you're coming in on the ground floor and you're looking at this, you get this, you can shoot for me. I own you while you're here.
Yeah.
And there's no terms listed, like if they pay these people or if they're just there for the experience. I think that that might unfortunately be the case. It has been in the past. I'd really like to have a music photographer like Steve Brazel. I know is a co-host on this podcast quite frequently, and he might be able to opine on this particular story, and we might update that in the future. I know neither of us are really music photographers, but this seemed like one of those things that I wanted to bring up as a story as we continue on. Not much to talk about if we don't have an in-depth opinion on it, though. But any closing words on this one?
Well, yeah, we don't have a huge opinion as far as music. However, I mean, the photographers I think that are really upset by this are really the ones that are more the press photographers and the journalists, because this is, you know, that their job is to capture these events or to capture these stories, and any sort of restriction to that really kind of harms that whole process of being able to do their jobs and communicate that. So I can see both sides of it. At the same time, I feel like digital photography is so pervasive. How do you stop people from shooting it? You know, gear gets smaller, more compact. It's kind of that same story where you go to a concert and they say no SLRs or professional equipment allowed, and yet your phone or compact cameras take as good or better photos in a lot of cases anyways.
Yeah, so, bring the Leica Q2 with you.
Yeah, right? Nobody's going to stop me. It's got amazing low-light performance. So what? You'd have to crop quite a bit, I guess. But, you know...
Hey, if you can afford the Leica Q2, you can afford close seats.
Yeah. And I mean, Don, here's the other question that I would put out for you is, okay, they're worried about shirts being made and mugs and all this kind of stuff and not getting to see a dime of that. But at what point is taking imagery and modifying it to your artistic taste far enough that it's no longer something they have a right to?
Okay, well, now that kind of leads well into the next story, and thank you for that segue, because the next story here is about Jumpman. Do you know Jumpman?
Yeah, it's sort of, I mean, the controversy is that Nike used a very similar image of a basketball player, arm up, ball in hand, legs spread. And
you can't just say basketball player here. This is Michael Jordan. You just got to say Michael Jordan.
It's Michael Jordan. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so he's doing a layup. His legs are completely spread out, almost like doing the splits in the air, just about. A hand spread out crazily and the arm just up, I mean, just like a passionate pose. You know, like I don't even know how somebody could do this and actually be successful in whatever endeavor they're doing. But it was an emblem, an icon. So the U.S. Supreme Court rejects a request to hear the Jumpman copyright suit against. Now, do you pronounce it Nike or Nike?
Nike. Yeah. Nike.
I always did when I was growing up, and then people say Nike. I don't know what to say.
Nah, I'm doing Nike. You know, right. I'm going to pronounce it the way that I did when I first saw this logo with my own eyes.
Okay. So I'm going to read again. This is a DP Review article. The U.S. Supreme Court will not hear Jacobus Co. Willem Rentmeesters. That's a lovely name. copyright case against the Nike Jumpman logo, the High Court has announced. The reason for the court's decision remains unclear, but it leaves in place the 2018 ruling by an appeals court that found Nike hadn't infringed on Rentmeester's image image copyright with its iconic Jumpman photo. But here's the thing, and it sums up in the final sentence here. The two images, while expressing the same idea, are different. And that's a really important thing to consider because, you know, if you get a nice creative idea, or if you take a photograph of, let's use a horseshoe bend with a fisheye lens and you do some amazing processing, how similar is your photograph of that particular iconic location to a million other photographers? Right.
Basically identical. And you bring up a really good point. I mean, you know, I think like anything, photography is changing. And that means that how we deal with issues, how we deal with copyright have to change too, because we now live in a world where images are so pervasive. You're right. It's almost impossible to take a photo someone hasn't already taken. So then how do we really claim that? I could see copying the image and using it. Plagiarism is all over the internet and it needs to stop. But being inspired by somebody's idea, going to the same location as somebody in similar light, we've already been down these roads and you can't make it a copyright issue.
Well, one of the scenarios I find myself in is I created an image back in 2009. I call Maple Leaf Flag, which is a bed of red maple leaves scattered about in the shape of the Canadian flag, on top of freshly fallen snow. And I might not have been the first person to come up with that idea. I searched online. I couldn't find anybody else. But after I published that, copycats have come up, taken the exact same concept. The background might have been birch bark and not snow and various different arrangements. But I can't copyright the idea. I can just copyright my execution of that. Right. That is my art form. However, it's different in specific jurisdictions. Are you familiar, Chris, with the red bus scenario in the UK courts?
I am not.
Okay, so this is a case, the case Temple Island Collections Limited versus New England Teas Limited, and another. I didn't actually dive into the whole details here, but I remember this from 2012. And there was a scenario where there was an iconic double-decker red bus, you can picture them in your mind, running across that bridge right in front of the British Parliament, and you got Big Ben in the background and everything else. And one company, Temple Island Collections, used their version of this image on promotional souvenir material and what have you. But another company, New England Teas Limited, wanted to use a very similar image. And so they recreated it. And the recreation is not anywhere near identical. Some of the process is, however, the red bus it's a false color image. So the bus is in color, but everything else is black and white. Okay. Right. So that a similar process, same location. The framing is entirely different. In one case, there's a stairway going up and it's a wider shot and the bus is a little bit more forward and there's a light post and everything. And the other shot, it's much more condensed. The bus is between the Parliament buildings and Big Ben and it's a different position and what have you. And so this came to courts for copyright infringement in the UK. And what jumps out at me, and I did some digging here, and I didn't give this in the notes that I gave you. I did this afterwards, so you might be unprepared for this. But Justice Bierce, B-I-R-S-S, Bierce, Byers, I'm not sure how I pronounce that name either.
Bierce, yeah.
But Mr. Justice Guy compared the two images and considered the party's arguments. And I'm reading from azrights.com here that had an article on this. The fact that the parties had produced their respective images independently from original photographs was insufficient to avoid copyright infringement. It is not the skill and effort of the author or photographer which is relevant for copyright purposes, but the effect of the final work. In particular, for a photographic image, Justice Guy considered the visual effect of the final image to be the most important element in determining copyright infringement. Wow. So whoever did that very first fisheye shot at Horseshoe Bend, if that was in the UK, they'd be suing people left and right.
It's such a tough call. I mean, we share so much imagery now. We put out so much imagery on the internet without a second thought. You yourself have had people infringe on your actual photos and images, right? And in those cases, I get it. I mean, you go after them, they're taking your hard work and they're using it. But if somebody takes my concept or my idea and recreates it, You know, I don't know if I have that same reaction. If they're inspired by it or they want to do it, we could argue that the vast majority of photographers are inspired by ideas, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if we look at it down that road, Pinterest, for example, is probably responsible for more infringement of ideas than any other idea on the planet. Like, oh, I'm going to build that cupcake holder because that looks amazing. I'm going to do that myself. I can do that. You know, I'm going to make that Halloween costume for my kid. Like, so I don't know. I feel like, as I say, the world's changing. You know, it's like if a comedian makes a joke and another comedian makes the same joke halfway across the world without hearing each other, it's going to happen. I'm sure it happens in photography all the time.
Well, and you also look too at the European Union. They have updated their copyright directive and Article 17. And I don't want to go into the details here, but basically, it could hold to account YouTube or Pinterest or whatever the publisher of the content more to account for copyright infringement, which means that you might have these people being scared that they might get liable to be sued, and they're going to be much more active in removing what they might consider copyright infringement, even though it might not be, and start pulling down content that could be in a gray area whatsoever.
Right.
And so you mentioned that we are in a new era here, and it is a rapidly evolving one because, I mean, the EU, if something happens, I mean, remember when they updated their privacy policy stuff and every website you've ever visited sent you an email saying, oh, by the way, in order to confirm with this new laws, we have to blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah. So if something happens in one major part of the world, it affects everything else, no matter where you live. Sure. And so all of these changes are churning together to create something that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, the laws are going to change much faster than they did because, in effect, aside from the weirdness around Disney and Mickey Mouse, the copyright law in the US remained largely unchanged since 1923, I think.
Yes.
And so we are now in an era that this can change on a year-to-year basis in one country that affects and ripples through everything else. So now hold on to your hats, boys and girls, because this is going to be a bumpy ride.
Now, you know, at the same time, I feel like, you know, we're both teachers. We teach photography. And I feel like idea infringement and mimicry of somebody's idea is actually an integral part to the learning process for new photographers. You know, that it's inspiration, it's learning techniques. And let's be honest, I mean, people are going to infringe on other people's ideas and imagery all the time with their phones and with Instagram and all this kind of stuff. And the fact is, because they're just, for lack of a better term, you know, just regular citizens, nothing will come of it. I think the main issues are going to be, as always they have been, if somebody starts making some serious cash, that's when the litigation begins. But if we're talking about, can we stamp out the concept of people taking other people's ideas? I think that's crazy and it's unrealistic. And so no, we can't. And I don't think we should. But when it comes to creative projects, making money and stealing things from other people, yeah, absolutely. And so as always, like I said before, we are always going to be swimming in a gray zone.
Well, and you can boil that back to the patent issue that I mentioned earlier very briefly, that, you know, you have a phone. There's like 1,000 patents associated with that.
Right.
And I love the patent system because it reveals the exact process for which you created something, which you have to register, and it will eventually become publicly available after a certain period of time. But you have every major tech company suing every major tech company over a patent infringement because that's the world that we live in these days. And there's billions of dollars being traded back, maybe not billions, but high numbers of millions back and forth in order to settle all of this down because the system, I don't want to say it's broken, but I don't think we have the time for that discussion today.
Yeah. That is why I continue to take only photographs that no other person in their right mind would ever want or attempt to try to recreate or see.
I second that notion. So let's talk about another photographer that maybe isn't taking any pictures at all in some cases. And so this is kind of, I like to end with a fun story when I can, and I couldn't really find one. So I found this guy, again, from DP Review, a Wisconsin videographer and also photographer in their studio, sued for more than $14,000 after court rules he botched 8 weddings. Now, Okay, well, botched weddings. Well, he's not the bride and the groom, and he's not the officiant and everything else. The wedding was probably still a success.
Right.
The people still probably got married, but his role in that was definitely called into question. And there were 9 people that brought this up as a joint lawsuit. 8 of the 9 were successful. 1 was dismissed. We don't know why, or at least I don't know why, because I didn't read all of the these legal documents. Become quite lengthy and not really worth my time for the, I don't know, 10 minutes we're going to talk about it. But so you look at these people that paid this this guy, what was his name? Scott Sockett. And he's gone under a number of different business names. So Say I Do Wedding Services was one. Another one was S2 Wedding Solutions. And there was a third one that I pulled up through the Better Business Bureau that I can't pull up. It's a verbal diarrhea here. There's just too much going on in this. But there was a third one, again, that those companies closed and he started another one. And so... okay, we have a guy that is promising a lot of different services, photography,
DJ
services, videography, of course, that was claimed, a photo booth, and uplighting. What is uplighting?
I'm assuming it's like a way to basically post-produce photos to give them that pizzazz and that look. That's my guess. Basic photo editing marketed as, you know, give me money.
Right. Okay. And half the time he never delivered the images that he took, or he left too early, or he never showed up at all. And I'm so glad that this scammer, at least under this one brand, has been taken to task. So he has to pay back $14,000 or $14,300 by multiple customers. But I think that this... before I go on, Chris, what do you think about people like this in our industry?
You know, I almost don't even want to make it about our industry. I mean, it is a photographer, absolutely. And photography is a difficult skill, and there is a lot to be delivered, and you can go wrong, right? I mean, you can mess up, you can forget to do settings, you can have camera failures, and that's ultimately not the client's fault in any way. But I think we're talking about any industry, right? I mean, you could make this about car repair, you could make this about carpet cleaning, it doesn't really matter. The fact is, you're always going to find those people in the industry that are hacks, that don't have the skills to back it up, or maybe just don't have the abilities to actually deliver what they promise, or are struggling to compete. What myriad of issues would bring somebody up to have to screw people over like this? But in the end, it's like any business. That's why we have a robust review system online now. That's why we have social media. I know he claimed that it was a competitor that was really trying to undermine him, but that sounds, at least to me, in my opinion, just a desperate attempt to try to stave off negative press. I mean, really, when this many people are claiming it, no matter what business it is, you're just not good at it. You just need to get out of it.
Yeah. And Magic Focus Weddings was that third one.
That's
that
the
I
other
just,
one.
Pulled up while you were talking. Okay, so $1,500 delivering multiple services for a wedding.
Yeah.
would you buy in at that price point?
Well, see, that's the other thing, right? I mean, anybody in the industry would know that if that's how little you're charging for all that kind of stuff, I mean, maybe this person is just trying to bite off more than they can chew and just not able to deliver. I've seen that personally many times in the photo industry and other industries, right? Where people just say, hey, I want to make a splash. I want to take all the business away from my competitors. I'm going to wow people. I'm going to overpromise. And of course, then they have to naturally underdeliver. And that's never a good business model. I mean, I think we've seen this story before. But at the same time, I think it's important for clients to realize if somebody is charging $8,000 or $10,000 to do your wedding, there might be a very good reason for that. And, you know, they're good. They know what they're doing and they will deliver. And if they're charging $500, they're either just starting out or it's questionable. Like anything, you have to get good reviews. You have to get word of mouth. Talk to people who've used their services. That's always the safest way. Buyer beware, right?
Yeah. And you know, I paid around $4,000 for my wedding photography services, and I'm very happy that I did. And that was there was no videography. However, my DJ, which of course was paid separately, just without me asking, set up a GoPro camera at his station and recorded everything, recorded the entire ceremony, the dances, and just gave that to us on CDs as a, okay, here you go. Here's an added bonus. We didn't ask for it. We didn't pay for it, but man, that was memorable because we didn't have a videographer. And so what did it cost him? Nothing. The cost of the GoPro, which is marginal, especially if you're doing a lot of this stuff, and the cost of a couple of blank CDs, that's pretty much nothing for what we pay for these particular services. And it didn't take him a lot of extra effort.
Nope.
Such a wonderful value add. So, I mean, as a photographic professional, I mean, we have deliverables. I have clients that commission specific products. And sometimes I realize, well, they asked me for, I had this client that gets me to do microchips and circuit boards and things like that, very detailed stuff on angles and complex focus stacking, whatever. But I think, okay, well, what if I just put it flat onto the focal plane and take another shot, and it's very little extra effort for me, and give that as a bonus once in a while. I mean, not every time. You don't want people to depend on that, of course. But what are the value adds that you could consider as a photographic professional that might take little extra effort or money for your part that would make your client say, you know what, I didn't expect you to do this. You didn't say you were going to do this, but I love that, and that makes me give that word of mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's your classic under-promise, over-deliver, right? You're always going to wow people when you do that. And as you say, it's the word of mouth. It's the great positive experience. And it sticks in your mind. So yeah, I think this is just a classic case of bad business management.
Yeah. And to think about the ways that you can take a business and push it forward. Like I mentioned, the DJ didn't have to do that. I didn't have to deliver that extra content. I have a customer that buys a lot of canvases from me, her own artwork. I'm her printer. A while back, she had ordered an 11 by 14 or something of that size. And I had enough room on that roll to print two of them side by side, even though she only ordered one. And I just kept that other one rolled up in a corner, waiting for her next order. And when that came in, I coated it because canvas needs to be coated with a special thing to prevent it from cracking and spills and UV and whatever else, and stretched it on a frame that cost me a couple of bucks. And I gave that to her as a bonus with the next order. And my material cost on that was almost zero. I mean, the cost of ink and coating and $4 to this client that has been a very good client to me. And they were really happy. You have to do this stuff to help keep those people loyal to you. I mean, you talk about brand loyalty or customer loyalty. That's valuable, but it doesn't have to cost a lot. It can be a very simple gesture and just some forward thinking that makes it happen.
Yep. In the end, I'm glad that these people were able to get a lot of their money back, you know, most of them. And so that's always good to see. But yeah, it's an industry. I know we've all met these people. They're not always, they're not always on the up and up. And it's a good lesson to learn.
Right. I won't name names, and I'm sure you won't either, but let's get into the picks of the week. Chris, I don't actually know what your pick is. So why don't you surprise me with that one?
Okay. Well, you know, I think if any photographer was asked what part of you physically takes the photo, everybody's going to say it's the eyes, right? But really, technically, the part of you that takes a photo is actually your hands. It's your fingers. And it sounds silly, but especially with the polar vortex madness that we just went through here, that honestly all of pretty much North America and Northern Europe went through, it was such a bad winter. And so my pick of the week is actually from a company called G-Tech, and they make a very interesting hand warming solution. So this is basically like a muff that you put your hands in, just like this cylinder that wraps up. It's insulated. And inside you have a lithium battery heated resistant wire. And that's really smart because it's not like a blanket that wraps around your hands. You actually hold onto the cable and it heats your hands from the inside, and it really gets your fingers warm. It's super lightweight. The lithium batteries are affordable. They're also lightweight. You charge them up, and on a low setting, we've had them go 8 hours. On a high setting, 3 to 4 hours. But the low setting is warm enough, and I think it's amazing. Out in the winter shooting, you can have it around your body on a strap. Put your hands in, warm them up, take them up and shoot. And as we all know, gloves are great, but they're not always ideal for shooting cameras with. And frankly, even with gloves on, your hands can get cold to the point where you cannot really use your fingers very effectively. So it's comfort. It has so many other applications that you can use it for, whether it's camping or, boat riding or fishing or flying or whatever you're doing. But photographers as well, I think, could really benefit. G-Tech hand warmers.
Okay, make sure you send me the link to that so I can put it in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com. But Chris, one quick question. When did you discover this particular product?
It's just a new product that's been going around. As we talked about, I do like to fish a lot, and I do like to do a lot of outdoor activities. And of course, Jordan and I find ourselves outdoors in freezing cold conditions a lot. So this actually came through a fly fishing store, and I looked at it, and it's an amazing product. Tried it out, played with it. I think they're under $200 Canadian. It's really quite reasonable.
The reason why I ask is because if it was before the last time I talked to you, I'm going to be mad at you.
No, it was after.
Okay.
It was after.
Because I spend an entire winter with freezing fingers. And if there was a solution that you had and you kept from me.
Don, last time we shot, Don, you were out in the winter in a t-shirt. Okay. So
true enough.
You have an insane metabolism. You generate enormous amounts of heat. I think you're fine. But no, I recently discovered it, but I would definitely look into it. It is an awesome product.
I'm going to buy one for sure. Maybe two. I don't know if I can, I think only my camera operating hand needs to be in proper performance, but
yeah, they make hoodies and stuff. And there's lots of other products like heated jackets and heated gloves and things like that. But what I really like about this is even in the wintertime when I'm doing photography, I still don't like to wear gloves because I do feel it takes away from my photographic experience. So having a place where I can use my bare hands, get my shots, and then warm them again right away. Perfect.
Awesome. Awesome. And my pick is something that I'm surprised I hadn't picked before, but way back, I bought an iPad 2 when it was first released, and it had a very long life for me as a photographic tool. I did camera club presentations and things with it, but it did not have a fully fledged operating system. It wasn't running Windows or OS X or anything like that. And if I wanted to have a mobile platform to like have the full version of Photoshop for every little eccentricity that I might want Photoshop to do, I'd have it. And then I looked to Microsoft with that. And I've been a Windows user for many years. There's no surprise there, but I bought the Surface Pro 3, and I got one of the fully decked out models of that time. And they're up to the Pro 6 now, I think. And more coming, I'm sure. It's one of their very successful products, but even the Surface Pro 3 today still holds up very, very nicely. I remember last year, I had my main motherboard in my computer die. This is a server class product with two processors and 128 gigabytes of RAM and all sorts of other stuff. But I was in the middle of my Snowflake series, and I had to edit images on a every other day basis. And I pulled up that Surface Pro 3. And it took longer, mind you, but it handled it just fine. And I use it for all of my camera club presentations, all of my editing when I'm traveling. It has a pen and touchscreen input, which is really nice. If you want to get a mobile platform and you don't mind a small screen, like you'd be looking at an iPad or something like that, these devices, even if you get a used one, because again, I'm using one that's three generations old and I'm still happy with it, it performs exceptionally well. It gives you my entire desktop environment, I use Thunderbird for email and everything else. It's all synced up to that. So whenever I leave, it's like I am still connected to everything that I have. And you also have the option to plug it into a dock that has immediately a keyboard and mouse and screen and everything. You can have it as a desktop replacement and then unplug it. And it's simply like a little tablet interface that you can walk around and consume content on. So I have been really happy with the Surface Pro 3. Again, they're up to the Model 6 now. If anybody is looking at it is something of a bespoke model. It's not cheap and it's really fine-tuned in the way that it's designed. But the Surface Pro tablets, I think, would be something to look at if you want bang for your buck. As long as you have enough bucks.
It's funny. When I got my computer last year, as we were making the move to DP Review that I could use for editing and whatnot, I need a new one. I took a hard look at the Surface products because they did fit a lot of – they checked a lot of boxes. And, of course, as you know, Jordan and I travel a lot with our gear. We have to take computers with us. And, I took a really serious look at it. In the end, I went with an MSI, I think it's a GP672 MVR, because it's a gaming laptop, it was strong, and for the money, it was really good bang for the buck. And I do take it everywhere with me, but that Surface looked like not only would it be easy to carry, but it would also really enhance and change how I edited photos and what I was able to do with it and how convenient it would be to use. And it just looks like fun to use too. I mean, it looks so slick. So,
well, we have to interject here too, because I usually record audio only, but I have a video feed going so that we don't talk over each other as often. And so sometimes if you hear me talking over a guest, it's because I can't see them. I can't see you, Chris, because your webcam software requires activation on this MSI laptop. And that is a pure design fail for me.
I haven't even taken the plastic off the webcam covering it. So, it's the one thing on this computer, which is still probably in good shape. So, but yeah, I totally get it. It's that ease. It's that convenience. I did take a really serious look at those.
Yeah. And they have they just announced the Surface Laptop 2, or at least a revision to that recently. And it separates from a keyboard, and the keyboard is more than just a keyboard. It has a battery and extra stuff in it too. Wow. So take a look at what Microsoft is doing with the Surface Laptop. If you are looking to buy a new computer, if you're going to buy a desktop, I have different opinions entirely. But if you're going to be buying a laptop or a mobile device, very small and the highest level of power, then the Surface stuff, I think I would recommend. And yeah, Apple fanboys, please email me. I'd be happy to try and convince you otherwise.
But keep your hands warm in the wintertime, Don?
If you hug it tightly enough while you're running some, benchmark, stuff like, I don't even know what that software is called. Like SciSoft Sandra was one that I remembered back in the day for measuring the CPU performance.
I always use 3D Mark
would do it. And that'll make it nice and warm and you can hug that. That'll do it. All right, Chris, well, we're winding down this episode. Where can people find you online?
Instagram is probably the thing that I use the most. So Chris.Nichols, just search for that. My last name is NICCOLLS. There are exactly 8 other people on the planet with that same spelling, and I don't believe any of them are YouTubers. So if you go on to Twitter, go on to Instagram, search NICCOLLS, it'll be me. You'll find me.
And if you have to type like photographer or DP review afterwards, even if you misspell his first name, you'll find the guy.
you'll get it. You'll get it. Yep. Check out my Instagram. Check out Twitter. I'd really appreciate that. Chris.Nichols.
And all of those links will be in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com, where you will find this episode and all of our past episodes. And I want to thank everybody that has been supporting this podcast. We're in episode 62 now. And we're going to keep going forever. I mean, so long as I have a voice, this is going to be a continuous thing. So the industry is not going away. It's getting more and more complex every day. And we are here with our finger on the heartbeat of it. You can find me at doncom.ca, D-O-N-K-O-M.ca. All of my social media links are there. And I'll repost all the Photo Geek Weekly stuff on my feeds too, just to make sure that you don't miss it. So, Chris, any parting words?
I'm so glad it's warm now.
And that is the perfect segue to the way we end every single episode, to get out and shoot.